So we come to chapter 8. I'll just read the first five verses. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal. So remember, we have seals, trumpets, bowls coming up, 777. And what we'll find is there's a pattern of 4 plus 3, or you could break it out to sort of 4 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, that in general terms, the 4 is universal in scope. It's a limited period of judgment that befalls the church in its entire church age. And then 1 acts as a kind of intensifier. So remember, 1 meaning 5. With the seals, this is the altars under the souls under the altar, altars under the souls. And then the 6th is the beginning of judgment, and then 7 is the end. So each of these is a way of saying, all right, it starts by opening the scroll, God's plan for salvation and judgment in the world. What does it look like? What is Christ doing in the world, and what is he going to be doing in the world? Each of these are giving a picture to say this church age. First 4 are dealing with the church age at all times and all places, then intensification in 5, and then coming to the end in 6, and then the end in 7, and then we start it all over again. So we left off with the 6th seal in chapter 6, and we answered the question in chapter 7 with a flashback and a flash forward, and now we pick things up. The Lamb opened the 7th seal. There was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Then I saw the 7 angels who stand before God, and 7 trumpets were given to them, and another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer. And he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Notice that language, and I'll show you the parallels in just a moment. But this is, if the 6th seal is the beginning of the end, here with the 7th seal, this is the end. And it's very stock language, which you'll see gets repeated several times in Revelation. Peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. But before that, we have to deal with this seemingly anticlimactic, kind of lame conclusion, doesn't it seem like? We've had 4 horsemen. You know, think of the ring race or something, although they're on their swooping things, or they're riding through the earth, and then you have the martyrs and the final judgment and this whole cacophony of noise and sound and judgment, and then the last seal is opened, and it's like quiet for a half an hour. Why that? What is going on with a half hour? Well, it's meant to demonstrate the short time before the hour. 9 times in Revelation, John speaks of the hour of judgment that has come or is coming. So the idea here, at least in part, is that this is a period of limited duration of waiting. So it's called a half hour because it's just before the hour. But more than that, the half hour of silence is for effect. Now, we just read it, but you imagine for John to experience it. The Lamb opened the 7th seal. Now, what has John just heard? He heard the 144,000. He looked, and this multitude, this amazing sight. He can't even count, and they're singing, and they're worshiping. And then here comes the Lamb. And to experience this live must have been something. And the 7th seal, and then I makes you feel awkward for 10 seconds, doesn't it? Imagine if I did that for 30 minutes. I might build an effect. So this happens for half an hour before the hour to build and to build. It, again, it's like a symphony that then takes one big breath, ready for the sound to come back in. The silence is about more than just a surprise or building anticipation, though it is that. It's also silent because silence is the appropriate response to the full unveiling of God's glory and justice. When faced with ultimate divine judgment, it's as if the whole earth, what's left of it, covers its mouth and stands in awe. It says, this is all throughout the Bible. Job 4, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. I will say no more. Isaiah 23:2, be silent, you people of the island. Isaiah 47:5, sin in silence, daughter of the Babylonians, or sit in silence. Lamentation 2:10, the elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground in silence. Amos 8:3, in that day, declares the sovereign Lord, the songs in the temple will turn to wailing, many, many bodies flung everywhere. Silence. Habakkuk 2:20, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. Zephaniah 1:7, be silent before the sovereign Lord, for the day of the Lord is near. Zechariah 1:13, be still or silent before the Lord, all mankind, because he has roused himself from his holy dwelling. This is the response and the appropriate response of the entire cosmos when they are now coming face to face with the unveiled glory of God. Silence. When you see something truly awe-inspiring, it could be walking into a cathedral or Grand Canyon or the Northern Lights or just something surprising. I remember going on a run in the woods years ago and just coming on the path, and then I mean, it was about this far was a great big deer. And we were both really scared, I think. Even though if we had both been logical, I thought, don't know that deers attack too many people, except our cars. The deer was probably thinking, no, I don't think this guy can take me with his bare hands. But it was just something large and surprising and unusual. And I just, like, both just silence. Here, God's judgment is coming. It's fitting that there would be silence. Lloyd-Jones wants to find a Christian as someone whose mouth has been shut. This seal, with a half hour of silence before the hour, what are we to make of it? Because what actually are the contents of the seal? Some people think this last seal is empty, that the contents of the seal just gives way to the seven trumpets, and that's partially true. There's certainly an interlocking piece. This is what happens with all the sevens. One seven ends, and it leads to the beginning of the other sevens. The trumpets are going to show us God's plan for judgment all over again, a recapitulation. The trumpets in the Old Testament signal God's presence of judgment. They signal warning. The priests blew trumpets in holy war. We know that this is the end and that the seven trumpets are backing up to show us the same thing again because of this language here, this theophany language in verse 5, peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. This is the same kind of language when God appears at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19. Let me show you in Revelation. So Revelation 4:5, what is the appearance of God on the throne? Flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder. So you have You see that? Can someone just, I think I just read it, but someone read Revelation 4:5. Let me write down what it says. Go ahead. You got Revelation 4:5?
No.
No. Revelation 4:5? Yes.
And the smoke of the incense. Oh, sorry.
That was it. Yeah.
I'm not in the right place. 4:5. From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder.
Okay. Flashes, rumblings, thunder. So that's 4:5 at the throne. That's the theophany. That's describing God. Now here, 8:5, we have, now someone read me 8:5.
Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth, and there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake.
So thunder, then it was rumblings, then flashes, and now we have an earthquake. So this is God appearing on earth. This is the end. Now this is going to happen several more times. So somebody give me Revelation 11:19. So flashes of lightning, then rumblings, then thunder, then earthquake, and now we have hail. It's not that it's not different. It's just it's the same scene of judgment, but as Revelation moves through, each one gets more intense. So there's one more. Read Revelation 16. And here you have to do, start with verse 18 and then to 21. Just do 18 and 21. So this theophany with God, thank you, 4:5, God is described, flashes, rumblings, thunder. So end of the world, thunder, rumblings, flashes, add an earthquake. Same scene again, it's getting intensified in its description, flashes, rumblings, thunder, earthquake, hail, and then the third time, flashes, rumbling, thunder, earthquake, but now it says it's the no earthquake we've ever seen before. And now the hail is massive, huge boulders of hail. It's very deliberate that 8:5, 11:19, 16:18 are showing us the same thing, which is one of the clearest signs that we're meant to read this as recapitulation. Otherwise, there's nothing left to be done. We're seeing, there's roll the tape all the way to the end. God shows up. All right, let's see it again. And from a different angle. And because Revelation is not just giving us repetition, it's recapitulation. It's another cycle, but this whole story as it's being told is moving somewhere. That's why each one follows with a further intensification. So this tells us that this seventh seal is now bringing the beginning of the end, which was in the sixth seal, now to its final completion. But still, what do we deal with? What do we do with this language in verses 3 and 4 and 5 with this censer? What part does this play? A censer is not a familiar word to most of us. A censer is something that holds or carries incense. So in a very liturgical church, or liturgical is not even the right word, but certain churches, the censer is an enclosed box and it's swung on a rope. In the Old Testament, the censer could be a small bowl or a dish or something like a shovel. Sometimes it's translated a fire pan because the fire or a live coal would be placed in it. So the fire in the censer is the result of the altar of burning incense. And, this is important, what is the incense? He was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints. The prayers of all the saints. Again, verse 4, the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints. Remember Revelation 5:8. When he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the face of the Lamb. Each had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. So we're given the formula right there. Incense here in this apocalyptic vision is representative of the prayers of the saints. Psalm 141, O Lord, I call to you, hear my voice. May my prayer be set before you like incense. May the lifting up of my hands be like the evening sacrifice. So even in the Old Testament, incense was a metaphor of accepted prayer. Fragrant odor, symbolic of the pleasure that God takes in hearing our prayers. There was a use of incense in Leviticus 16, the Day of Atonement. The high priest would take a censer of burning coals, grab two handfuls of incense. He goes past the curtain into the Holy of Holies. He puts the incense in the censer over the coals, and the smoke of the incense conceals that mercy seat. It says, so he will not die. It was a means of protection for the priest. Remember in Luke 1, Zechariah, John the Baptist's father, was chosen by lot to go burn incense in the temple. And it reads, and when the time for the burning of incense came, all the assembled worshipers were praying outside. So there's just another example. Incense and prayers, always connected. From the Day of Atonement to the sacrifices to Zechariah here in Revelation, that the symbolism of incense wafting into the air, a pleasant aroma, are like our prayers ascending to God. So why is this here in Revelation 8? Well, it seems to be the case that God completes his final judgment as a result of people praying. The seventh seal is broken. The final part of God's plan to judge and save the world is executed in response to the prayers of all the saints. Another angel came, stood at the altar with golden censer. He's given much incense, the prayers of the saints, the smoke of the incense. And the angel took the censer, filled it with fire, threw it down on the earth. He takes fire from the altar, adds it to the censer full of our prayers, hurls it down, this concoction, in a final act of judgment. Now you might say to yourself, but I don't even know if I like that. I don't pray for final judgment on the earth. I'm not even sure I want to. But think for a moment. Don't you want to see evil vanquished? Don't you want to see the innocent vindicated? Didn't you want to see Inigo Montoya stab the six-fingered man who killed his father? Yes, you want to see justice. Don't we say in the Apostles' Creed, Jesus is coming again to judge the living and the dead? And when you say, come, Lord Jesus, come quickly, do you think Jesus is just coming to give everybody fist bumps and high fives? He's coming to wipe away tears, and he's coming to judge. It'll be the full revelation of his glory, his majesty, and his power. So here's one application as you think about your life and minister to others. 99% of Christians feel dissatisfied with their prayer life. Maybe 100%. I do know some real prayer warriors who maybe feel good about their prayer life, and they should. Most of us, myself included, feel like, of all the things I'm good at, it can feel like prayer is not one of them. And one of the things we struggle with in prayer is you have your devotion. So I'm going through my Bible this morning, and then I usually go on a walk for my prayers. It's harder to fall asleep when you're walking, and just kind of helps me to think. But they usually feel, you know, your prayers don't feel like SpaceX rockets, like going into the stratosphere. They feel like just not much of anything. One of the great pictures here is twofold. Our prayers, even the weakest prayers given from a heart of faith in Jesus' name, are incense rising to heaven, and God, He's not there. You're such a bad prayer. Why do you pray so little? Why are you so distracted when you pray? Yes, let's learn how to pray better. But it's a heartfelt prayer is a sweet incense that arises, and God says, my people are praying. That smells good. That's like Carolina barbecue wafting out. That's a good smell. And the other side of the imagery, all of our prayers, which feel, you know, all of our prayers, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. How many billions of times has that prayer gone up in the history of the world? And it doesn't feel like much. And the picture here is this angel is taking all of those prayers, thy kingdom come, and he hurls them down. Here it is, all those prayers answered. You don't see it all right now. In fact, you may feel like, I don't see a lot of the kingdom coming right now. How come the bad guys are getting ahead? How come my tears haven't been wiped away? And here's a picture of at the end, it's the angel taking the censer and all the incense of all of the prayers of God's people in the church saying, here it is, here's the answer. Christ is here. It's a great encouragement for our prayers when they feel weak, and they usually feel weak, and how they will come back to earth one day with great strength. God is finally issuing judgment and salvation on the earth on account of his people praying. So look then at verse 6. This room, yeah, I see you guys are all putting, I can even put my coat on. I see you guys are getting chilly. If you were my wife, I'd let you wear my coat, but you're not, so you'll just have to be cold. Let's look at verse 6 into chapter 9. Let's just have somebody right now read through the rest of chapter 8. Did we leave off on, did Chip read? You did. So we are on Nathan. Let's give us the rest of chapter 8.
Now the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood. These were thrown upon the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. The second angel blew his trumpet, and something like a great mountain, burning with fire, was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many people died from the water because it had been made bitter. The fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened, and a third of the day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blast of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow."
Thank you. As we go through this, hopefully it begins to make more intuitive sense. Remember with the four horsemen, And I've been arguing that these fours are clumped together. The four horsemen, remember the last one, death, would be affect a fourth of the earth. It doesn't make sense if we're reading these literalistically. It gets to be a very complicated math problem. So a fourth of it is gone, and now a third of it is gone. No, these languages of portions or partitions are a way of saying God's judgment is still restrained. That's why it was a fourth, and now here it's a third. Just a way of saying that God has not yet unleashed with these first four the fullness of his anger and wrath and justice. And remember the horses, that imagery was taken from Zechariah. You can probably tell more easily that these first four trumpets all are related to the 10 plagues. In fact, each of these first four trumpets, I think, have an Old Testament counterpart, a possible natural meaning, and then a metaphorical meaning. So an Old Testament meaning or referent, a natural possibility, and then I think most importantly is the metaphorical or the spiritual. Just to look at each of these quickly. So the first trumpet, hail and fire. This is the seventh plague. From Exodus 9, the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. Hail fell and lightning flashed back and forth. So this is akin to the seventh plague. There's a possible natural meaning. Hail destroys a limited amount of vegetation on the earth. Could be a reference to actual hail. But the metaphorical meaning. The other metaphors are obviously more spiritual in nature. So I think that this one, too, is making a spiritual point more than a meteorological point. It says, hail and fire mixed with blood, they were thrown upon the earth. A third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. This one may be a reference to the work that armies do. Hail destroys vegetation, could be a metaphor for famine. Trees and grass burnt up as a literal scorched earth policy as an army goes throughout the earth. And we're probably not meant to see exactly, oh, what exactly does this mean? But it's just evocative of the sort of destruction, not unlike the same kind of destruction we saw with the four horsemen. And then you have the second angel blew his trumpet, and a mountain is thrown into the sea, which then becomes blood. So this is like the first plague. Moses raises his staff in the Nile, and all the waters turn to blood. Again, scholars think, well, is this about a volcanic eruption, perhaps like Mount Vesuvius, which covered Pompeii in 79 AD? Maybe. That would be a mountain erupting, thrown into the sea, and the molten is like blood. But more importantly, and I don't know that John is writing thinking I'm making volcanic predictions, it's more likely the great mountain thrown into the sea is symbolic of a great kingdom being cast down. That's usually in apocalyptic literature what mountains refer to, kingdoms and strength and throwing down. Jeremiah 51, I am against you, O destroying mountain, you who destroy the whole earth, declares the Lord. So this is likely a picture of God judging the kingdoms of this earth so that there's partial death, destruction, and disruption. And then trumpet 3 is a fallen star and bitter water. Remember the first plague, again, made the water undrinkable. Maybe there's a reference to the bitter water at Marah in Exodus. And this may have a natural reference that water actually would become polluted and poisonous to drink. He predicted that in Jeremiah 9:15. Wormwood is a bitter herb that can make water deadly if you drink enough of it. But the metaphorical explanation is what's most important. John is seeing this vision that because of God's judgment, people will experience bitterness and suffering. The prophets sometimes spoke of wormwood and gall. Now we think of that sometimes with reference to Christ on the cross, the wormwood and the gall, but it's a way of describing their pain. And then finally, trumpet 4, darkness. Again, the ninth plague. Maybe this is an image naturally of warfare with smoldering cities, burning fields, smoke ascending that would darken the sky. But this isn't a literal description. The earth could not survive without a third of the sun and a third of the moon. This is not a road map to the end times, and this is another reason why we have to take this as recapitulation, because wait a minute, I thought the sun and the moon were already done. Now we're just eating up a third of them, because it's the same thing, just a different picture. I think this is a metaphor for spiritual blindness, people deluded and led astray. The Jewish book Wisdom of Solomon makes this connection, quote, "For when lawless people supposed that they held the holy nation in their power, they themselves lay as captives of darkness and prisoners of long night, shut in under their roofs, exiles from eternal providence." So the Egyptians were the real slaves. They were in darkness, separated from the one true God. That's what the Wisdom of Solomon there says. So with that as a possible Jewish reference, I think the darkness here is a spiritual darkness. The point, just like the four horsemen, is that these are realities that are throughout the world. Each trumpet blast is the Lord proclaiming his victory and also issuing a warning for traitors to repent, just like the plagues. The plagues were a sign that more is coming, and it's an opportunity, Pharaoh, to let your people go. The plagues were a sign of God's judgment. Now, judgment to come and an opportunity to repent. Same thing with these trumpet blasts. The angels are warning. You think of the image of the shepherd who's the watchman on the walls and an army is coming. That's the job of the watchman. You blow the trumpet to say, disaster is coming. That's the image of the trumpet. We also see that it's a pattern of decreation. Each trumpet affects a third of three parts of the created order. The first trumpet affects a third of the earth, a third of the trees, a third of the grass. The second affects a third of the sea, a third of the living creatures, a third of the ships. And then the third, a third of the rivers, a third of the springs, a third of the waters. And the fourth, a third of the sun, a third of the moon, a third of the stars. So it's an obvious pattern, just like I'm sure you learn in your Pentateuch class. With Genesis, the flood is told deliberately as an echo of the creation story in Genesis 1 and 2. All the things that came into being and the separating of the waters and the heavens above and the earth beneath, Noah's flood is all of that in reverse. So now the expanse, waters below, waters above, are flooding the earth from two different directions. It's a decreation. Well, the same thing is happening here. God, who's been hailed in chapter 4 as the one who made heaven and earth, now he is rightly judging the earth with this act of decreation. Just as God in the beginning created the sea and the living creatures and the vegetation, now this is an evidence of the world's curse under judgment, a decreation of the natural world, which, like the flood, was making way for a reborn, renewed creation.